Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, a Federal Transit Administration audit of CATS finds 18 issues regarding safety protocols, which leads City Council's Dimple Ajmera to call for changes.
That people can see and feel when they ride.
29 more measles cases in South Carolina. CMS finally returns to normal operations and class schedules. Tom Tillis pushes again for answers from Border Patrol on Operation Charlotte Web. The I-77 express lanes through uptown may turn the interstate into a double-decker highway, and Charlotte Symphony Orchestra music director Kwame Ryan wins a Grammy.
Moments like these could be so inspirational for the people who will follow.
Plus, can you say Luke? Luke Kuechly in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Here to talk about those stories and more, WFAE's political reporter Steve Harrison is here. Joe Bruno's a reporter for WSOC-TV. Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming back.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to begin, though, with something that I have not yet mentioned. That's the latest tranche of the Epstein files released by the Department of Justice, containing about 3 million documents. And so, since we were all snowed in, we gave WFAE's Nick Delacanal some light reading to do, a little assignment for him. And lo and behold, he found a familiar name in that latest tranche of files, and he joins us at the top of the program to share what he found. Whose name leapt off the pages to you?
It was our Panthers owner, David Tepper, as a matter of fact. I had some free time this week, and I just kind of started putting names in, just Charlotte figures. And I, you know, did a lot, you know, Hugh McCall, Michael Jordan, even Ric Flair, they didn't show up. But I was very surprised to see David Tepper's name. Now, we should be very clear, there is no direct correspondence between David Tepper and Jeffrey Epstein. All of this, it was more of third parties mentioning David Tepper's name, or in one case, Epstein is mentioning David Tepper's name in an email to Bill Gates. Really, I think the most notable thing in here was an email that a redacted sender had sent to Epstein. I think it was at 2 a.m. In 2014, July 5th. Saying that they just met David Tepper at a party and he was very funny. And Epstein replied saying, well, if you see him again, invite him to breakfast at my house with Bill Gates. Now, there is no indication that the two ever directly emailed, or even that David Tepper took Epstein up on this offer. And I will say, David Tepper's press people had a lot of calls with us when they learned that we were writing this story, and they wanted to stress very much that there was no direct correspondence. But it does show, because I think a month later, Epstein wrote an email to Bill Gates with this long list of wealthy individuals that included David Tepper. And he said, who do you know or would like to know, or who do you like? And it just kind of shows how Epstein was really trying to network and name drop. At the time, Tepper was a prominent hedge fund manager. He didn't buy the Panthers until 2018, and this is 2014 again. It really just shows Epstein trying to, I guess, have this collection of wealthy people that he could network with. I think that that's really it.
Yeah, I want to stress that just because a person's name appears in these files does not mean they've done anything wrong or really had any connection directly with Epstein. And as you pointed out, Tepper is neither a sender nor a recipient of any of these emails. Epstein just wanted to invite him to breakfast because, as you say, he was very smart and very funny. Now, I know you mentioned that you had contact with the Panthers organization. What, if anything, has David Tepper had to say about all of this?
They have not commented at all. I think that they definitely were concerned when this came up. And as I said, we had some conversations, but they did not want to comment on this. And kind of left it at that.
So there are 3 million documents that were released in this latest tranche of Epstein file documents. Are you done with them, or are you just settling in for a lot more reading over the next several weeks?
I have still been looking around and seeing if there are any other Charlotte connections. I think this is really the only one that has jumped out. But
so Joe Bruno's name is not on this? Is that right?
No, I don't think so. But if anyone has any tips, certainly give me an email or drop me a line.
Nick Delacanal, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. In the aftermath of the murder of Irina Zarutska on the Blue Line last August, the Federal Transit Administration launched an audit of Charlotte Area Transit System Safety Plan, and the results of that audit were released this week. Joe, what did it show?
It was 18 violations or non-compliance points that the FTA found against CATS. I think there's a difference. When the state auditor investigated CATS, there were some concrete things that he pointed to, and like not having like the shift from armed security to unarmed security. With these findings from the FDA, it seemed like to me it was more administrative things. So not necessarily something a passenger would interact with or could necessarily tell on the system.
FDA Administrator Marcus Molinaro says that his federal agency is, quote, determined to do its part to address the systemic failures within Charlotte's transit system that led to Irina Zarutska's tragic death. And he blamed CATS for safety lapses that created an environment ripe for what happened. Those are his words. But when speaking to WCNC-TV, Charlotte City Council's Dimple Ajmera says she wants to get past the blame.
This report is not about blame. It's about identifying problems and fixing them.
And among the problems mentioned in the report are CATS not meeting the requirements for its safety performance targets and not implementing the safety risk assessment processes established in its own safety plan. Were these safety targets and items in that plan set by CATS itself or by an outside body, Steve?
I am not certain. I believe that some of these reports or some of these plans are probably required by the federal government since CATS receives a good chunk of its budget from the federal government. But to Joe's point, you know, when I went read through the audit, and it was a bit of an alphabet soup, and that it was very jargony and very procedural. And like Joe said, it wasn't focusing in on like key points of security was not on this train or this level of staffing. You know, it was things like they weren't doing the proper de-escalation training with their operators. I don't think there was any way the FTA was going to give CATS a pat on the back or any kind of encouragement or your things are going in the right direction in this audit. I mean, as we're going to talk about later in the show, this killing has reverberated really far and wide politically. And I think that CATS was going to get beat up over this.
Joe and Ryan want to jump in here. I think, Joe, you had your...
Yeah, I'll just say that, you know, even though it's not saying like or citing specific security failures, like not having a guard at a certain time on a certain train or something like that, it is certainly an audit that they have to take seriously. They have like 30 days to correct these administrative errors. And the FTA is not an organization or agency that the city wants to be on the wrong side of. Like they need to work with the FTA if they want to accomplish half of what they want to do over the next 40 years.
Ryan.
Right, and just zooming out to your first question, I just wanted to point out that one of the sticking points at city council meetings has been, why can't you tell us what the crime numbers are on transit in Charlotte? And they found the crime rate to be 3 times higher than the national average on CATS vehicles, but even more, I mean, also notable, that they found the violence rate against drivers and against staff members to be 5 times higher than the national average. So obviously they're going to want to prioritize protecting the passengers, but also, I mean, these CATS staff members are already so underpaid and they need to really work on protecting those folks.
And that was one of the things that the operators and the bus drivers were complaining about. I think it was last summer or the summer before last, that they were concerned about their own personal safety. And as you point out, Ryan, the report says the rate of assault on CATS employees has risen to 5 times the national average, and that passenger crime rates were 3 times the national average just last year. Alex, do they have any understanding? Does CATS understand? Why?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it honestly, before the killing, it seemed like CATS was going in a really positive direction. Like, we were talking a lot about how buses were no longer as delayed, and it seemed like Brent Cagle was doing a really great job. So it is, I'm interested in seeing the actual raw data on what this means when we're saying it's 5 times or 3 times and how big of a jump that actually is. And we don't have those numbers yet. But I think it's just a matter of like this audit is showing that CATS just has not been prioritizing safety as much as it should be in these audits. And maybe they got too focused on trying to correct those other issues, like making sure buses are actually reliable. This kind of planning work kind of got tossed to the side.
The first several talking points released from this report include these. CATS did not implement its required safety risk assessment process when assessing assaults on transit workers. CATS did not monitor whether safety risk mitigations were implemented as intended. CATS did not establish or implement a process to monitor whether safety mitigations were effective. CATS failed to establish all required general safety performance targets. CATS did not establish a required annual safety performance assessment process, and on and on and on and on. And the report also puts a spotlight on operator training with regard to de-escalation. Are they saying, Steve, that CATS is not conducting that training?
Yeah, I think that was one of the criticisms that they made, or the findings that they found, was that the de-escalation training is not there. Now, I think that's not a particularly big issue for on the light rail, because the operators are enclosed in their own cab. But for bus drivers, it's a huge deal because they have so much interaction with the public asking for their ticket. I mean, and we've seen a lot of these incidents over the last few years where there are fights on the buses and confrontations between passengers and drivers.
Aside from the murder of Arina Zarutska on the Blue Line in August and the stabbing that occurred, I believe, on the Blue Line in December, outside of those incidents, what others might have been avoided had operators had sufficient de-escalation training, or if more stringent safety provisions had been put in place? What other things happened on the light rail or on the buses?
There have been stabbings. Oscar Solorzano is accused of stabbing Kenyon Dobie on the light rail. There was no security present. There have been stabbings on buses. There have been fights on buses. Not every altercation or incident where de-escalation comes into play necessarily makes the news. It could be a fight between two people arguing on a bus. So there are certainly incidents that have happened that possibly could have been prevented or toned down had operators jumped in.
Is it fair to expect bus drivers whose job is to drive the bus to be psychologists and de-escalators, Alex?
That's what I was thinking, because that just does not sound like part of the job description. And with this sales tax increase and the new transit regional authority, there's a lot of talk happening about CATS getting their own police force, which could be a lot more useful than trying to train bus drivers on how to tone down really heated arguments on a bus while they're also trying to drive the bus.
A couple of more things to talk about with regard to this report that came out from the FTA, CATS has 30 days to respond with what they're going to do or what they have done to fix those problems. And then we'll talk about I-77. Big changes coming to I-77. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on the local news roundup on listener funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's politics and transit reporter. Joe Bruno is with us, reporter for WSOC-TV. Alex Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Katz has said that it has been focusing on making safety improvements since August, and that has certainly been the focus of City Council. Dimple Ashmira.
We can have committees, we can have a plan, but it's not enough to just have a plan on paper. We need real changes that people can see and feel when they ride.
That's Dimple talking to WCNC-TV, and they also spoke with some light rail riders who agreed. Here's how one of them reacted to that FTA audit.
I do feel we need more security at the stops, but with the way it's set up right now, I don't know what we could really do to fully enforce all that.
So last week, Katz announced a new method of collecting fares on the train, which is not in effect yet. But is that part of any attempt, Steve, at improving safety and security on the train, or is that something completely separate?
Yeah, I think this is mostly about safety and security, and not necessarily collecting revenue. The idea is that you need to validate your ticket before you get on the train. Like they want to install scanners on the platform that you and other transit systems have done this, where you would scan on your phone or your ticket, and it would show that you've paid as you get on. I mean, right now, in a sense, you can ride for free and have the app pulled up. And if you ever see someone ask for your ticket, you can buy your ticket, you know, right there in 30 seconds. So they want to do this validation system. They want to start charging for the streetcar. And the idea generally is that if you have paid the $2.20, then, you know, it calls people who aren't really riding the train, who are just there for fun or warmth or you know, to waste time or whatnot. And so that's a huge part of this.
How does it make you safer? How does it make you safer? You can buy a ticket and carry a knife.
Yeah, but if there are more people checking for tickets, it's, you know, not one thing is going to necessarily make it safer. But if somebody's checking for tickets, then, you know, maybe they're looking for knives. They are considering using AI technology as well to address some of these issues. The AI would come into play if those validators as being able to tell whether or not somebody actually scanned their pass or their card when they boarded a train. And if the AI flags you for not paying, then a security guard can respond immediately and just go after that one person who didn't pay, where instead of, you know, going around to each person individually and saying, can I have your ticket? Can I have your ticket?
So following the murder of Irina Zarudzka, Katz implemented, or they began implementing, new safety protocols. Have they had any impact?
I think there's a more visible presence of officers now. I think that anyone who rides the light rail or commutes can say that they are seeing more ticket checkers or security officers than they used to. The crime didn't happen on a light rail, but I feel like I'm at the transit center for something at least once a week. And the transit center is much safer now. And that partly goes back to them getting rid of all the retail options, because there's just no loitering. If you're at the transit center, you're only there to ride a bus. So I feel like the improvements they made over 2025 have helped, and they just kind of need to keep going and really restoring the public confidence that was lost as a result of these incidents.
So Steve, Katz now has a lengthy history of problems, particularly when it comes to safety and maintenance. The maintenance issues several years ago were blamed on now departed former management. The safety issues that have cropped up, however, and continue to crop up, have been occurring under interim CEO Brett Cagle. How should we view this?
I think when Brent Cagle became interim, the biggest crime problem in the transit system was on the bus network and at the main bus station uptown that Joe just talked about. And Brent Cagle had moved to fix that. You know, he had it like we just talked about, moved the restaurants and the stores out of there. He'd increased security. That was a huge focus. And the Link's blue line security and the idea of checking for tickets and having security was something that just wasn't on their radar. And so it's often hard to see, you know, where the next problem, we kind of always fight the previous war, right? We it's hard to see what's going to crop up in the future. And, you know, and so kind of an example of that today. Right now we have security all on the Link's blue line, which is great. I think it does make people feel good. I don't think we have that same level of security on the Gold Line streetcar. It's just not on people's radar. And maybe, you know, maybe it won't be necessary, but it's not something that city council asks Katz about. What are we doing about the Gold Line?
Joe.
I would just say Brent Cagle is highly thought of and respected. In many ways, he is like a firefighter because he is just putting out all of these fires that have popped up. And a lot of these controversies aren't necessarily of his making. He inherited kind of a mess. And ever since then, you know, he's just been interim forever and trying to keep the train on the tracks.
You reported this week, Joe, that the man accused of killing Irina Zarudzka, DeCarlos Brown, was on a list for early release because of the for a previous problem that he had. He was in jail because of the COVID-19 pandemic. He was going to be released, but he was in fact not released for that. What was he in jail for at the time, and why did they decide not to release him along with 3,500 other people who were released?
So this is a complicated story, but it is going to be a story that I think we hear until the November election. Back in the height of COVID, activist groups, NAACP, ACLU, a couple other groups, they sued Governor Roy Cooper because they wanted offenders in the prison system to be released due to the fear of COVID. Cooper's admin pushed back. Eventually, the group settled, and Cooper agreed to release 3,500 offenders. The list was never made public until this week. And on that list is the inmate number of DeCarlos Brown. However, and here's where it gets complicated. So despite being on the list, Brown was not released early. He served his whole sentence, but then got arrested and had to go back up for essentially a parole hearing. And the parole officer was like, we'll let you stay on your post-release supervision. But the Cooper team was allowed per the settlement to put people like that on the settlement list and count them as the inmates who was released. So he was on the settlement list, but he was not released because of it. He was added retroactively. And at the time, he was serving a sentence for armed robbery or robbery for dangerous weapon.
This is coming out now, obviously, because Tom Tillis is retiring from the United States Senate, and the leading Democratic candidate for his replacement would be the former governor, Roy Cooper. Cooper's spokesperson says that anyone claiming that Cooper allowed Brown to be released, quote, is lying. Is that essentially accurate?
What's really interesting is my report on this story was shared by both the RNC and the DNC, and both of them were claiming that their sides were right based on my reporting. So I'm not sure how to feel about that. But Brown was on the list, but Brown was not released because he was on the list. Now, where this list is going to come into play over the next 8 months is there are 3,500 names on it and or 3,500 inmate numbers on it. So I have a feeling people are going to go through that list, look at the inmate numbers, and then try to match them up to their criminal history or what they did after they were released. And that's how this is going to become a story over the next couple of months.
Toll lanes are coming to I-77 from uptown to the South Carolina line. We've known that for quite a while. The question is how to make that happen, because real estate on either side of I-77 is at a premium. The right of way is extremely tight, and there has been some pushback from folks on the west side, which is really the only place you can push that highway, because they're concerned about losing more homes, more neighborhoods to that highway. Yet again, this happened once before when the highway was originally constructed. NCDOT has come up now with a solution. Steve, what is it?
Yeah, their plan to kind of, in their view, lessen the impact is to elevate the toll lanes through uptown. So part of the highway would be a double-decker. There would be toll lanes on top of the regular lanes. That the DOT says will mean they have to demolish, buy and demolish fewer homes in places like McCrory Heights. The cemetery, Pinewood Cemetery uptown, would not be impacted. There would be, they would have to take less land for Fraser Park. So in a way, it is a, the impacts are less. However, the people on the west side understandably still don't like this plan. I mean, they're going to have bridges really, really close to their house. There'll be noise pollution. It'll be ugly. And they are really, really fighting back against the DOT's plan. And they don't like either version. And there's some people who want the DOT to explore putting the highway underground for a short stretch through uptown to, you know, kind
yeah, here's
of dig a trench
one,
and cap it.
One area resident told WCNC in his reaction to this proposal.
I don't think it should come through residential. Still, people live here. You're going to have a highway with noise. You're going to have all kinds of collisions. It's just going to take away the peace that we have here.
So the NCDOT came to this decision after talking to 2,000 people in neighborhoods nearby for about a year. And as you mentioned, some people want to bury the lanes. The reason for these extra bridges would be what? For flyovers to get into and out of those toll lanes? The toll lanes themselves would be on top of the highway, correct?
Yeah, the toll lanes would be on bridges. And so that means, you know, on top of the existing lanes. So you don't have to go as wide. You don't have to push the highway out as far and take as many homes. One of the controversies is that the DOT has been, like you said, engaging in public meetings on this for a long time. But the two options, the elevated option was really, I believe, only unveiled last fall. I mean, it was maybe November-ish that they had some public meetings, and then people were just digesting the idea of the elevated toll lanes. And then here we go into early February, and the DOT makes their decision. And I think that has surprised and upset some people. They felt like it was too fast.
So which is more expensive, just building a normal highway and widening it, pushing things out to the west side, building it as an elevated highway, or burying it? What's more expensive?
I think clearly burying it would be by far the most expensive. Elevating it is more expensive on the construction, but you do save on land acquisition. The DOT, I don't think, has given cost estimates between the two proposals it's talked about.
So they've been talking about this and getting neighborhood input for about a year. When this will continue to evolve, they say, over the course of the next several years, when will construction start? When will they make a final decision on whether it's going to be elevated? And when will construction begin?
Construction won't start until after 2030. So right now we're just in the design stage, and things could still change because they're just saying right now we're moving forward with elevated bridges. They still have a lot of work to do between designs and environmental studies. So there could be a chance that the CRTPO revisits this if there's enough mm-hmm. public pressure. There was a lot last night. Malcolm Graham held a town hall that got, it seemed like from videos, pretty rowdy. People are really upset. And Malcolm Graham's not really to blame here. He is the city council member who just represents that district. So he was just trying to hold a forum to hear opinions, but people got really upset and he ended up actually ending that meeting early. So, but there was no NCDOT representation there.
Do we know if the incursion onto the west side into these neighborhoods will be less if they do it as an elevated highway as opposed to just expanding the highway? Would it be substantially less if they were able to afford to build it underground?
I don't know if we know about the underground theory because we haven't seen any renderings. We don't know a whole lot about the underground. In theory, there would be less of an impact if we go underground. There is less of an impact if we go above ground, but there is still an impact.
If you go underground, what will that do to traffic on I-77 for the next 10 years? You have to tear the highway out, don't you?
They basically said that that's not an option.
There's a lot of people in general who just, you know, they say they're open to options, but really just a lot of people don't want this built because people are eager to see public transit over highway infrastructure, especially in these uptown areas. That's what they prioritize. This is helpful for people who live you know, in Gastonia who are trying to get to their jobs and they live in the suburbs, but people who actually live in these neighborhoods are never going to be happy with a highway project, whether it's, I mean, maybe they'll say underground, they might, that's might be the best of the three options, but really they just don't want this bill. It's a lot of environmental damage, it's public health, it's, there's the theory that induced demand, that's very well proven, that if you build more highway infrastructure, eventually it will just become clogged again because you're driving more growth and more homes are being built along that highway, and then people just come back to the roads. So I just don't think they really want to see it at all.
Can you blame them? I mean, you look at the northern section, it's going to cost you $40 to go one way in the morning. And, you know, people are losing their homes. This is encroaching on historic neighborhoods, and they're already paying taxes for roads. And then they're seeing, wow, I'm going to have to pay $40 if I want to avoid traffic to just to get to Steel Creek. No. So you really can't blame the residents for being upset about this. The problem is, what's the alternative? I don't know if there is an alternative. The alternative is doing nothing, and traffic is already terrible.
And eventually, when this is done, they allegedly will connect all these toll lanes. The northern toll lanes will be connected with the southern toll lanes, and the southern toll lanes will connect with the I-485 toll lanes, which are about to open. As long as we're on the subject of transit, you reminded, Steve, listener, you reminded listeners of that, of the $80 million spent on track and signal work in 2022 that's needed to open the Gateway Station uptown. It would bring passengers, rail passengers, to uptown. But the city was on the hook to build a waiting area and a ticket office before NCDOT could move the Amtrak station from its present location near NODA on Tryon. And none of that has yet happened. And now there's a question of whether this project will be transferred to the new Metropolitan Public Transit Authority. So what's the story here?
Yeah, you know, Alex has done, last fall, did some of the best reporting on this, looking at the tensions between the city and the state over this long delayed project. And I was curious as to, you know, who's going to take the lead now to try and get Gateway Station open? Will the city still be involved, or will they turn this over to the new Public Transit Authority? And, you know, the city does not seem to be willing to part with this project. I mean, they kept talking about the authority as a partner in it. So now we will have, it seems, you know, more people involved at the table, the state, the city, and the transit authority. You know, they could, in theory, get a temporary station built very quickly. The transit authority will have the money starting this summer. They could do it. I'll just be curious to see if there is a big push to move Amtrak from, you know, the old kind of dirty small station uptown on North Tryon to the new place uptown.
And of course, there's still some argument or indecision about what form this new Gateway Station will actually take. We'll look into that in a moment when we come back. Also, increasing numbers of measles cases, particularly in Spartanburg, but also now spreading into North Carolina. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC-TV. And Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. We were talking about the Gateway Station, which is supposed to be located uptown, where it will bring in rail passengers from Amtrak and give them a chance to transfer to light rail, etc. There have been three options on the table about what form this will take and what should be the outcome of what this looks like. And David Howard is the chair of the Metropolitan Public Transportation Authority Board. He says he would prefer to follow through on the city's original version rather than a standalone Amtrak station.
I will continue to advocate for it to be a mixed-use development. But absolutely, the quickest way is just to build an independent building. I just don't think that's what we want in downtown Charlotte.
So this mixed-use development seems to be right up the city's alley, Steve. Why have they been dragging their feet on building this?
The problem is that this is a partnership with two private developers, and the office market is not good right now. Work from home is still a big thing, so people really aren't building much office. And, you know, it's just when you create big projects, big public-private partnerships, you know, I often kind of say they become too big to succeed. We look at Brooklyn Village, just a couple miles away. That's been 10 years now. The county has been trying to develop that. And so, you know, waiting for everything to come in to alignment with the private developers and the state and the city and the authority, it just makes these things really difficult. Maybe it will happen in the next 2 or 3 years. We'll see.
Okay. The number of measles cases in South Carolina continues to spread. The number was 762 last week. This week, the number surpasses 870. And this has been centered from the very start in Spartanburg County. Why can't they get a hold on this, Ryan? They've quarantined the young kids who have come down with measles over the period of time this has been going on. Why can't they get a handle on it?
Well, I would say that it's just that's how viral of a disease, of a virus this is. It spreads. It can be in the air 2 hours after someone leaves a room. And if you look at the stats on the dashboard for each state, you'll see that at least in North Carolina, I'm not sure the percentage in South Carolina, but North Carolina, 74% of the people who have been infected are unvaccinated. So, I mean, when you see this huge rise in some of our first outbreaks since this virus was eradicated in 2000, you have to look at the rise in unvaccinated in the anti-vax movement and see why it's really hard to get a grasp on something as it's after the fact.
And it's spreading in South Carolina. They've had a case now reported in the PD region in Sumter County, which is near the center of the state of South Carolina. There's been a case reported in Lincoln County now. What about Mecklenburg? We've had one or two. Have we had any more?
Right. So the last time the dashboard was updated was on Tuesday, and it'll be updated again today at noon. So as of Tuesday, there were 3 in Mecklenburg County. That's second most behind Buncombe, who has 6 in the state. And there's 15 statewide, but that doesn't even count the Lincoln County one that was found. So I'm expecting an increase when they update the numbers today at noon.
And in South Carolina, the majority of the infected people have been unvaccinated children and teenagers. The MMR vaccine, which is the vaccine that prevents this, has been widely and safely used for decades. It is 97% effective in preventing measles, which is highly contagious. It spread through the air and by person-to-person contact, and it can linger in the air in a room that somebody with measles has been for 2 hours. Just so you can be aware for that. That's why it's so contagious, I guess. CMS and other area school systems were dealing with a double whammy of weather incidents with ice 2 weekends ago and about a foot of snow last weekend. And finally, after a few days of virtual school and days of delayed openings, CMS went full time yesterday. This is the first full day of school since January 22nd. So how much of this will have to be made up, Joe, and how do they plan to do that?
So right now they're just taking 2 half days and making them full days. And I know that there were so many parents who were ecstatic to see that they were back in school for a full day. And I know there are a lot of people who lost money because they bet that CMS wouldn't return for many, many weeks. But, you know, one thing that helps CMS right now and will help them in the future is this state law that was passed, I believe in 2022, that allows districts to count remote learning days as actual instruction days. So even though the kids might get a worksheet that they look at for 10 minutes at home, it still counts as a school day, and they can use those remote days up to 5 times a year. And I believe CMS still has 2 of them. So that's working for them if we get another storm over the next couple of weeks.
And the good news for students who don't want to be in school in June, making up for snow days, is that Superintendent Crystal Hill told the board the system has enough wiggle room built in to meet the state-required minimum of 1,025 instructional hours this year, even with the disruptions of the last 2 weeks.
We do not need to make a change to this year's academic calendar in order to comply with state law or Board of Education policy. However, we do want to provide every opportunity for students to be back in school and learning in person.
Of course, it wasn't just the schools that had to deal with winter weather. Snow played havoc on the roads. Joe, I saw you on TV last weekend for hours reporting on terrible conditions on I-85 and that pileup that involved about 100 vehicles. Where exactly was that pileup? Joe, are you there?
I'm here now. That was weird. I heard snow. I assume you're talking about I-85.
Yeah, I-85. Where was that big pileup that you spent hours covering?
So that was glad to be back here. I might still be in a pileup right now. That was in Kannapolis. It was in the Kannapolis Concord line. Basically, what happened was there was a jackknife tractor trailer, and flipped in the snow, and all the cars behind it got stuck, and they couldn't move, and then it just kept snowing. And then those cars got stuck, or those cars collided into others, and it was just kind of snowballed from there on the National Guard while they got all these tow trucks that flew in from other counties to help clear this. They actually got everybody back moving in about 5.5 hours, which isn't bad, all things considered. But a scary moment if you're stuck on I-85 and just see snow coming down and you're in a Hyundai along.
Anybody hurt?
Nowhere to go.
Anybody hurt?
No one was hurt. No one was hurt.
Okay, good. Charlotte Douglas officially recorded, I think, 11 inches of snow. The heaviest snow fell in Cabarrus, Gaston, and Rowan counties, with Harrisburg leading the way. They had 13 inches of snow. Where does that place this storm, Alex, in the pantheon of winter weather events down through Charlotte history?
One of the records I saw was tied for fourth highest single day snow total in history. Bringing it a little bit closer to modern day, this was, if you added up all the snow in the past 10 years, this is more than that. So it was very significant. And I think it's kind of funny because we haven't had this much snow in so long. I think that might have contributed to the road problems some more. A lot of people moving here and not realizing that we're being serious when we say do not drive in the snow and ice.
We don't have enough plows. The fourth highest single snow day in history matched December 29th, 1880. That's how far back we have to go. The Urban Institute released numbers this week that show that between 1970 and 2023, North Carolina's household income has grown at a slower rate than its southern neighbors. Alex, what else do these numbers show?
Yeah, we grew 24.3%. So our neighbors, I think the most interesting one is probably Virginia. They grew 60%. Virginia, we're usually tied with them, or we're competing with them on these like best state for business rankings. So it is a little bit interesting. It's just a matter of, I think, mostly losing manufacturing jobs. That might be playing into it. Apparently, we're doing really well on other factors, like the states that have a lot of college-educated people or a lot of foreign-born, a high foreign-born population, those did well in this ranking. But I think just because of the loss of manufacturing jobs, that ended up not having us place very high compared to the rest of the South.
Yeah, we grew 24.3% as opposed to Virginia, as you pointed out. They grew 60.1%. South Carolina, 31.9%. Georgia, 33.8%. Tennessee, 32.6%. So we are lagging. Retiring North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis has been increasingly vocal about how the Trump administration is conducting some of its operations, particularly those involving ICE, and about the people who run those operations. This week, he sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, pushing for more information about how U.S. Border Patrol operations in Charlotte last year were conducted. In that letter, he applauded some of their activities, but, quote, at the same time, multiple public reports allege that U.S. citizens were detained, subject to force, and experienced damage to personal property. Joe, has he heard back from Kristi Noem?
No, not to my knowledge. He has not heard back. You know, I think there's still not just Senator Tillis, a lot of lawmakers who want to know more about Operation Charlotte's Web. And I'm not sure when we will ever learn about it unless it comes up in a hearing or documents get posted from a FOIA request. It might be quite some time.
Tillis also wants to know how many people were detained during Operation Charlotte's Web, how many of them had prior criminal records, and he wants it before Kristi Noem testifies before the Senate Judiciary Committee on March 3rd. DHS has been opaque, that's a good word, about that kind of information. The Observer also asked them to produce similar information, and DHS simply did not comply. Ryan, are they likely to provide this information at any time in the future to Tom Tillis?
I don't see that happening until more people step up. Tillis obviously is a lame duck at the moment, and he's not under pressure by the Trump camp as much. But, you know, this used to be one of the things that Republicans were all about is, you know, their whole mantra was don't let the federal government run wild and do whatever they want. And now we have a federal government that doesn't even want to let us know who they're abducting off the streets. And I know people email me and get upset that I use the word abducting, but until we know who the people are, how many of the people are and who that they've taken, then I would call that an abduction. And until more Republicans speak up, I don't think we're going to get many answers.
And evidently, the way that ICE, we're seeing how ICE operates because it's on television and it's in the streets of American cities now. And evidently, this is how they've been operating at the border since 1924. And no one noticed because they were out there by themselves. They are undertrained and they're a paramilitary force. The 68th Annual Grammy Awards were handed out in Hollywood last Sunday, and among the recipients was the Charlotte Symphony's Kwame Ryan.
Let me start by thanking the Recording Academy for this recognition, which means so much. And speaking for myself personally, as a Black conductor, we're a small demographic, but getting less so one generation at a time, and moments like these could be so inspirational for the people who will follow.
So, audio from the Grammys broadcast on CBS. This was his first Grammy nomination and his first Grammy Award. What did he win it for, Alex?
He won Best Opera Recording for Intelligence. This is actually a big moment for Ryan. He's been a bit of a trailblazer. He was named the first person of color to lead the Charlotte Symphony, and now he's the first music director there to be nominated and win a Grammy Award. So it's a very big deal.
And that recording was with the Houston Grand Opera, not the Charlotte Symphony. But critics noted the extraordinary clarity that Maestro Ryan brings to the podium. Charlotte Symphony audiences already know that. He's in his second season as conductor there and music director. And Ryan has now become the first, as you said, first music director in the orchestra's 94-year history to have been nominated, much less to have won a Grammy. And he did not forget Charlotte in his acceptance speech.
I'd also like, on a personal note, to thank my amazing partner, my family, and my incredible group of friends at Charlotte Symphony Orchestra for showering me with support, which makes moments like this possible.
And making that moment possible evidently took a Herculean effort because of the snow. I read, Alex, that he spent 12 hours at the airport, and at 2:30 in the morning, he took an Uber to Atlanta?
Yeah. I would have been freaking out. He was at the airport. He was there for 12 hours. At one point, he was on a plane, and then they told him to get off, and then he went home. I guess you can take an Uber all the way to Atlanta, and then got to Atlanta, took a flight to L.A., made it to the theater after the Grammys started, and then was there just in time for his acceptance speech. So
amazing. Amazing. Panther legend Luke Kuechly voted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame last night as part of the class of 2026, which includes Drew Brees and Larry Fitzgerald and Roger Craig, to name a few. Some were speculating that he wouldn't make it because of his relatively short career, so obviously voters prioritize peak performance over longevity. Joe, take us back to the halcyon days of Luke Kuechly and the Panthers.
I mean, one of the greatest Panthers of all time, one of the greatest football players now enshrined in the Hall of Fame. When you watch the guy, I mean, it was just incredible. And we only got 8 seasons of him. He was all pro in 7 of them, Pro Bowl 5 times. He was a stud in every sense of the word. He had a short career, but an impactful career, 100 tackles, I believe, in all of those 8 seasons. And just a special person who deserves these honors.
Yeah, he continues to live in Charlotte, and interestingly enough, in his off time, he works with former teammates Greg Olsen and Jonathan Stewart, coaching the Charlotte Christian Middle School football team. Amazing, amazing. Do you have time to tell we have 30 seconds, do you have time to tell the French Bulldog story?
Yeah, a French bulldog was abducted and held for ransom, allegedly. And they ended up catching the perpetrators. And as part of their punishment, the court documents said they had to give back the bulldog. So it just appeared in front of animal control. And now the rightful owners of Julio have been reunited.
And we should mention that the Charlotte Hornets won last night, extending their winning streak to 8 games. That's the longest streak since winning 9 in a row in the 1998 season. Steve Harrison, Joe Bruno, Alexandria Sands, Ryan Pitkin, thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.